Part 1. The morning sunlight spills lazily through the dusty blinds of our New Orleans office, casting long, slanted shadows across the hardwood floor. It's just another day in the glamorous life of a private eye. I'm idly thumbing through a stack of unpaid bills, trying not to think too hard about the dwindling number in our bank account. My partner, Ash, fiddles with the ancient coffee maker in the corner. "Rain, I swear, this thing is older than the city itself." Ash grumbles, giving the coffee maker a gentle whack. The machine sputters in response, begrudgingly starting to brew. Ash runs a hand through his graying black hair, his deep-set eyes reflecting years of experience and a hint of untold stories, lighting up with a smile as he watches the coffee drip. I lean back in my swivel chair, watching him. "I think it's a good metaphor for us. Old, a bit rough around the edges, but still kicking." Ash rolls his eyes, but smiles, pouring two cups of the strong stuff. "Here's to us, then. The antique detectives in New Orleans," he toasts, handing me a mug. I take a sip, feeling the warmth spread through my body. I glance at the calendar on the wall, noting the date. I'll be turning 33 in exactly 1 month. It feels like just yesterday that I was a rookie police detective full of hopes and ideals. Now, here I am, running a private investigation firm with my husband, dealing with the gritty, often thankless realities of our job. Before I can respond, Louise, our secretary, peeks her head into the room. She's the grandmotherly backbone of our office.
"Rain, Ash, you've got a new client, and from the looks of it, this one might actually be able to pay,"
she says with a wink. Curious, I walk over to the window and peer through the dust-speckled blinds. Parked right outside is a sleek, black Rolls-Royce Phantom, a contrast to the array of beat-up sedans and pickup trucks that our clients usually drive.
"He says his name is Mathis Beaumont,"
Louise added. The name sounds familiar, but I can't quite put my finger on it. I exchange a look with Ash, a spark of interest lighting up his eyes.
"Thanks, Louise. Send him in,"
I reply, setting my coffee down and straightening up in my chair. The door swings open, and in strides, a man who looks every bit the part of old money, well-tailored suits, crisp white shirts, and a silk tie. His hair is a distinguished salt and pepper, cuts impeccably. He must be in his 50s, but there's a vitality to him that belies his years.
"Detectives Rain and Ash are trying, I presume?"
he inquires. "Yes, Mr. Beaumont," Ash asked, standing to greet him.
"Yes, my apologies for the unannounced visit. I hope I'm not intruding," he says, his voice carrying a cultured, almost melodious quality.
"Not at all. Please, take a seat,"
I say, motioning towards the chair opposite our desk. Beaumont nods gratefully and sits down, casting a curious glance around the office.
"You have quite the charming setup here."
"We like to think it has character," Ash replies with a half-smile. "Now, how can we assist you, Mr. Beaumont?" Beaumont hesitates, his fingers drumming lightly on the armrest of the chair.
"This is somewhat of a delicate matter," Beaumont begins, his voice betraying a hint of discomfort. "It's not something I'd normally bring to a private investigator."
He pauses again.
"But I've heard of your reputation for discretion and effectiveness."
"Rest assured, whatever you tell us will be handled with the utmost confidentiality," Ash said. As I listen, I try to place where I've heard his name before. His demeanor suggests more than just wealth. There's an air of influence about him that's hard to miss. As Beaumont continues to explain his predicament, it suddenly hits me. My patience for his beating around the bush wears thin, and I blurt out,
"Are you by any chance related to the Beaumonts of the Garden District?"
Beaumont pauses momentarily, taken aback by my directness.
"That's correct,"
he admits.
"I see my family's reputation precedes me."
"Your mother is Camille Beaumont, isn't she?"
I ask, recalling the matriarch of the family. A flicker of surprise crosses Mathis's features.
"Yes, she was. My mother passed away recently. It's quite sudden. A stroke."
"I'm so sorry for your loss," I interjected.
"The city lost a great patron, and we lost a beloved family member,"
His voice carries a mixture of respect and sorrow, the kind that comes from losing someone larger than life. Mathis shifts slightly in his chair, the weight of his next words apparent in his demeanor.
My mother left a considerable fortune to her surviving children in her will. However, there's a complication.
He starts, his gaze steady but troubled.
I have a younger sister, Margot.
I raise an eyebrow, surprised. I wasn't aware you had a sister. He sighs.
Margot was, well, a free spirit, to put it mildly. She and my mother often clashed. Margot never quite fit the mold of the Beaumont family. Her ideas, her way of life, was all too unconventional for my mother.
Sounds like an interesting family dynamic, Ash comments. Mathis gives a rueful smile.
Indeed, but things escalated beyond the usual family squabbles. About 25 years ago, they had a particularly fierce argument. It ended with Margot running away from home. We haven't seen or heard from her since.
25 years? I repeated with a shocked tone. It's quite a long time to be estranged.
Yes, it's been difficult for our family, especially for my mother. Despite everything, she always hoped Margot would return.
He pauses, his gaze distant.
That's why in the financial act of reconciliation, she left a portion of her estate to Margot as well.
So, you want us to find Margot? I ask, already considering the complexities of a case spanning over 2 decades.
Exactly.
Mathis confirms.
Find her, let her know about the inheritance, and ideally, bring her back.
I lean forward, my detective instincts kicking in. You seem certain that Margot ran away. Is there any possibility that something else might have happened to her?
Mathis nods, acknowledging the question. I've considered that, believe me. But the night Margot left, she took a substantial amount of cash from my mother's safe. She also left this.
Omar reaches into his jacket pocket, pulls out a slightly faded Polaroid photo. He hands it to me carefully, as if it's a fragile relic of a forgotten time. I take the photo, studying it closely. The Polaroid shows a young woman, presumably Margot, in her late teens. She has dark, curly hair and intense hazel eyes, conveying a fiery spirit and defiance. I peer closer at the photo, noticing the background. It's dimly lit, with the unmistakable ambience of a jazz club. Next to her, partially out of frame, is someone else. All I can see is part of a profile, perhaps the curve of a cheek, a hint of a smile. It's frustratingly little to go on, but the proximity of the two in the photo suggests a close relationship. I flip the photo over and find Margot's handwriting on the back. It's a quick, scrawled note, the kind written in a moment of impulsiveness. It reads, "Running towards a new life with Alex, away from the gilded cage. Don't come looking for me. M."
"Do you know who this Alex is?"
I ask. Mathis leans forward, squinting at the photo before shaking his head.
"I wish I knew. I assume it's the other person in the photo. My theory is that she ran away with him."
Ash, ever the pragmatist, frowns slightly. "Do you have any idea where they might have gone?" Mathis sighs, the lines on his face deepening with the weight of unfulfilled hope.
"No, I don't. After Margot left, we tried to track her, but she was like a ghost."
"Did your family involve the police at the time?" Ash asked, still examining the photo. Beaumont nods slightly, his expression one of lingering frustration.
"Yes, we did. But since Margot was over 18 and appeared to have left of her own volition, there wasn't much they could or would do."
"Can you recall anything about the days leading up to Margot's disappearance? Any unusual behavior, visitors, or conversations?"
I ask.
His expression turns somber.
"I wish I could provide more specifics, but there was a large age gap between us. I was already out of the house, pursuing my career, when Margot was still in her rebellious teenage years. We were never close, not really."
"What about your mother?"
I ask.
"Does she remember anything from the night Margot left?"
He pauses, gathering his thoughts.
Her mother was always tight-lipped about their falling out. It was a taboo topic in our household. All I know is that it was a bitter argument about Margot's lifestyle and choices.
I don't like the odds. Finding someone after a quarter century with only a faded Polaroid and a name is like finding a needle in a haystack. Mr. Beaumont, I start, trying to choose my words carefully. I understand the importance of this matter to you, but I have to be honest. The chances of finding your sister with so little to go on are slim. She could be anywhere. Could have changed her name, her appearance.
Mathis nodded, his expression solemn yet understanding. I'm aware of the difficulty, Detective. I've considered that she might not even be... Well, that she might not want to be found. But I have to try. It's my last promise to my mother, to at least attempt to reach out to Margot.
Ash leans forward, resting his elbows on the desk. We're not saying it's impossible, just that it's going to be a tough case. We'd be starting from almost nothing. Beaumont reaches into his inner jacket pocket and pulls out a small notepad and a pen. He scribbles something quickly, then slides the note across the desk towards us.
If you can find Margot, or at least find out what happened to her, this amount is yours.
I pick up the note. My eyes widen at the figure written there.
Putain!
I exclaim under my breath. It's a staggering amount, the kind of number that would not only cover our unpaid bills, but also secure the future of our little agency. I look up at him, my surprise evident.
This is very generous of you, Mr. Beaumont.
He gives a small smile, tinged with sadness.
Money's not an issue. The only thing that matters to me now is honoring my mother's last wish.
I exchange a glance with Ash, and I know he's thinking the same.
We'll take the case, Mr. Beaumont, I say, my voice steady. We can't guarantee success, but we can guarantee that we'll give it everything we've got.
He nods, relief clear in his eyes.
Thank you, Detective Tran. That's all I can ask for. One more thing, detectives, he says in a measured tone. Discretion is paramount. The Beaumont family name carries weight in this city, and I prefer not to have our private affairs become public spectacle. Whatever you uncover, I ask that it remains between us.
There's a moment of silence as his words sink in. The way he emphasizes it leaves a slightly bitter taste in my mouth. It's not just about finding a lost sister. It's about maintaining the untarnished facade of a family that's been a cornerstone of New Orleans society for generations. I exchange a glance with Ash, seeing a similar conflict in his eyes. We need this case, and we need it to be successful. I nod, masking my reluctance with professionalism.
You have our word, Mr. Beaumont. Discretion is part of our service. We'll handle the matter with the sensitivity it requires.
He seems relieved, offering a curt nod of appreciation.
Thank you again. I trust you'll keep me updated with any progress.
We will, Ash assured him as he escorts our client to the door. Once the door closes behind Beaumont, I let out a long sigh, feeling the weight of the task ahead. We start our investigation with the scant leads we have, the faded Polaroid, the name Alex, and the knowledge of Margot's estrangement from her family. Ash and I divide our tasks. We take the streets, starting with the jazz clubs, hoping someone might remember a girl like Margot. We spend hours visiting each one, showing the Polaroid to bartenders, regulars, anyone who might have been around in the late 90s. But nobody remembers her, or they're not willing to say if they do. Through interviews with people who knew her, I learned that Margot was pursued by numerous suitors, all handpicked from the cream of society. But she turned them all down, much to her mother's chagrin. This could very well have been the source of their falling out. The possibility that Margot has drastically changed her appearance and is living under an assumed identity is a reoccurring thought. I scour through social media and public records, yet every lead fizzles out, leaving us no closer to finding her than when we started, Foul play also lingers ominously in the back of our minds. We painstakingly go through the list of unidentified persons reported around the time of her disappearance. We compare photos, descriptions, and even dental records when available, but none of the cases match Margot's description. While it's good news that these tragic fates didn't befall Margot, it also means we're still in the dark about her whereabouts. Our investigation, extensive as it is, finds no public records, no financial transactions, and no sightings that could be definitively linked to her after that fateful night. It's as if the night Margot ran away, she has simply dropped off the face of the earth. As the investigation unfolds, the mystery of Alex becomes as elusive as the search for Margot herself. None of the family members, friends, or social acquaintances I interview recall any man named Alex in Margot's life. This absence of information is puzzling, leading me to consider two possibilities. Either Alex was a very well-kept secret, or he entered Margot's life shortly before her disappearance, under circumstances unknown to her inner circle. The breakthrough comes unexpectedly. Ash and I are in the office late one evening, surrounded by piles of notes and maps. I'm about to suggest calling it a night when Ash suddenly sits up straight, a look of realization dawning on his face. "Rain, I think we've been looking at this all wrong," he said, his voice tinged with a mixture of excitement and uncertainty. I look up, intrigued. "What do you mean?" He starts shuffling through a stack of papers, his hands finally landing on a faded employment record. "What if Alex isn't short for Alexander, but for Alexandra?" I'm taken aback by the suggestion.
"Alexandra?"
"Yeah," he says, pointing to the document. "Alexandra Sinclair. She worked briefly in Camille Beaumont's household around the time of Margot's disappearance. It was a short stint, and she left abruptly, according to these records." The implication of what Ash is suggesting hits me like a wave. Could Margot's Alex have been a woman? We pore over the employment record. Sinclair was hired as a personal assistant to Camille, but her employment lasted less than 3 months. The records didn't say much else, but it's more than we've had for the entire investigation. I examine her employee photo. A standard black and white image, but it's her profile that catches our attention. The curve of her cheek and the hint of a smile match the obscured face in the Polaroid. It's not definitive proof, but it's something. We start tracing Sinclair's movements after she left the Beaumont household. However, it's like chasing a ghost. After days of relentless digging, we finally uncover her last known address in the lower Ninth Ward. It's a far cry from the grandeur of the Garden District where the Beaumonts reside. We decide to pay her a visit. The lower Ninth Ward, a neighborhood profoundly affected by Hurricane Katrina, still bears the scars of the disaster. We pass by empty lots overgrown with weeds, houses in various stages of disrepair, and the occasional new construction trying to breathe life back into the area. We pull up in front of a modest, somewhat weathered house. It's clear that, like many in this area, it has seen better days, but there's a sense of care to it. A freshly painted door, a small garden struggling against the odds. We walk up to the front door. I knock on the door, my heart pounding with anticipation and a hint of apprehension. Moments pass, and the sound of footsteps approaches from inside. The door creaks open, revealing a woman in her mid-40s. Her features resonate with the face in the Polaroid, but time and life have etched their own story upon her.
"Can I help you?"
she asks cautiously.
"Miss Sinclair? Alexandra Sinclair?"
I inquire, my voice steady but respectful. She hesitates, then nods slightly.
"That's me. What's this about?"
"My name is Rain, and this is my partner, Ash,"
I start to say. She cuts me off, her tone firm.
"I'm not interested in whatever you're selling."
As she begins to close the door, Ash quickly interjects.
"Wait, we're not selling anything. We're private investigators. We're looking for Margot Beaumont."
The mention of Margot's name halts her movements. Alex's face hardens, her eyes narrowing with a mix of suspicion and defense.
"You tell Mr. Beaumont I've kept my end of the deal,"
She has no right to harass me after all these years.
Miss Sinclair, Camille Beaumont didn't send us. She's dead.
I explain, hoping the truth will lower her guard. Those words seem to strike her like a physical blow. The defensiveness in her posture falters, replaced by a stunned disbelief. She stares at us for a long moment, processing the information.
Miss Beaumont is dead?
She finally murmurs, her voice barely above a whisper. Her expression shifts from shock to what looks like relief. I nod solemnly.
Yes, we're just trying to find out what happens to Margot.
I don't know why you're here or what you're trying to dig up, but I want no part of the Beaumonts or their affairs. She states firmly, her voice tangled with a lingering resentment. Desperate, I reach into my pockets and carefully pull out the faded Polaroid. Holding it out towards her, I ask gently,
Miss Sinclair, is this you with Margot?
Alex's eyes fix on the photo, and for a moment, her facade falters. She hesitates for a moment, scanning our faces for any hint of duplicity. Then she steps aside, opening the door wider.
Y'all best come in.
As we step into her modest living room, Alex seems to gather herself, the initial shock giving way to a wary composure. She motions for us to sit on an old but well-maintained sofa.
I'm sorry. This has been a bit overwhelming.
She admits, her voice steadier now.
You said Camille is dead?
Yes,
I reply gently.
Her brother, Mathis, hired us to locate her.
Ding dong, the witch is dead.
Alex scoffs.
You don't have a high opinion of Miss Beaumont, I ask.
You could say that,
she retorts. I suppose you want to know about me and Margot.
We do,
Ash replies gently.
Anything you can tell us will help. Were you two friends?
Margot and I, we were more than just friends.
She confesses, a hint of a smile playing on her lips.
We were in love. In love?
I ask, my jaw dropping. This piece of information reshapes the entire narrative.
Yeah, it was a whirlwind, you know? Two young women against the world.
She pauses, her gaze distant.
But Margot's family, they would have never accepted us. They had their image, their expectations. Margot and I, we knew we couldn't live that lie.
Ash leans forward, attentive. So, you planned to run away together? A sad smile flickers on Alexandra's lips.
Yeah, we talked about it, dreamed of it. A place where we could be ourselves, without judgment, without the weight of the Beaumont name. But the night we were supposed to leave, Margot didn't show up. I waited for hours, but she never came.
I sit back, genuinely taken aback by this revelation. Alex's face darkens as she continues.
Camille found out about us,
she says, her voice tinged with bitterness.
She confronted me, fired me on the spot. But that wasn't enough for her. She threatened to destroy my life if I ever tried to contact Margot again.
Did you try to reach out to Margot after that?
I ask. Alex shakes her head, a sad resignation in her eyes.
I couldn't. I was scared. Camille Beaumont was a powerful woman. She could make good on her threats. I love Margot, but I was just a nobody. I had to protect myself.
Ash leans forward, his expression sympathetic but probing. What do you think happened to Margot that night? Before she could respond, she is cut short by the sound of the front door opening.
Mom, I'm home,
a voice calls out. The teenage girl steps into the living room, her eyes widening slightly at the sight of us.
Oh, I didn't know we had visitors.
Alexandra's eyes flicker towards us, a silent plea evident in her gaze. Her daughter doesn't know about any of this, and she doesn't want her to. Thinking quickly, I stand up and offer a reassuring smile.
Hello there. We're with Entergy. We're checking on reports of electrical issues on the block.
Everything seems fine here, ma'am.
Ash says, playing along.
Thank you for your time. We'll see ourselves out.
The girl seems unconvinced, but shrugs and heads towards her room.
Okay. Weird, but whatever. Hi.
She says with a brief wave before disappearing down the hallway. As she disappears down the hallway,
Alex lets out a quiet sigh of relief.
Thank you,
she murmurs to us. As we make our way to the door, Alexandra follows us, her steps hesitant. At the threshold, she leans closer, lowering her voice to a whisper.
If you really want to find out what happens to Marco, I suggest you look into the skeletons in Camille Beaumont's closet.
Initially, Mathis is vehemently opposed to our idea. He insists that the family's private residence has nothing to do with Margot's disappearance and that our investigation should focus elsewhere. His resistance is palpable, perhaps due to a combination of guarding family privacy and an underlying fear of what we might uncover. However, as we persist, emphasizing the importance of exploring all possibilities, Mathis begins to relent. He allows to agree us access to the mansion, but under one strict condition. He must be present during the search. We arrive at the Beaumont Mansion in the Garden District as the sun sets, casting a golden hue over the grandiose structure. The mansion stands hauntingly imposing, its Gothic architecture reminiscent of a bygone era. Ivy crawls up its stone walls, adding to the sense of age and mystery that envelops the place. Mathis leads us through the towering front doors into a foyer that feels more like a museum than a home. The air is heavy with a scent of old wood and faint traces of lavender. Family portraits line the walls, their eyes seeming to follow our every move. The interior of the Beaumont mansion is a labyrinth of rooms and corridors, each one preserved, almost as if Camille Beaumont herself might return at any moment. The grandeur is overwhelming, yet there's an undercurrent of something misaligned. It's not just the antiquated decor or the way the evening light casts eerie shadows through the stained glass windows. It's as if the house itself is holding on to secrets, reluctant to reveal the truths hidden within its walls. Mathis flips the switches, illuminating the opulent corridors with a warm, artificial glow that seems almost invasive in the quiet, hollowed space. He follows closely as we begin our meticulous search, his gaze sharp and unyielding, like a sentinel guarding a sacred tomb. We start in the main study. Volumes of literature, history, and art line the shelves. I carefully scan each book, hoping to find hidden notes or letters, while Ash examines the desk, sifting through old letters and faded documents. We move through the mansion methodically, exploring Camille's private chambers, where time seems to have stood still amidst dust-covered furniture and boxes of old photographs. The search is exhaustive, but frustratingly fruitless. As the evening progresses, Mr. Beaumont's patience wears thin. His initial reluctance has transformed into outright annoyance. He paces the hallways, frequently glancing at his watch, his demeanor growing more agitated with each passing hour.
This is pointless, Mathis finally declares. You're rummaging through my mother's personal belongings like common thieves. It's clear you're grasping at straws.
His words hang heavily in the air. I ignore him, taking a moment to look around, trying to find a new perspective. It's then that I realize what's odd about the mansion's interior. Despite its age and historic design, there are subtle signs of extensive remodeling. Inconsistent flooring patterns, patches of fresher paint on the walls, and even some mismatched architectural details. It's as if certain parts of the house have been deliberately altered or updated.
Mr. Beaumont, I began, turning to face him. Have there been renovations in this house?
Mathis pauses, his irritation momentarily replaced by a look of contemplation.
It was some of an obsession for my mother towards the end of her life. After Margot left, she began changing things around the house. At first, it was just redecorating, but then it became more comprehensive.
Comprehensive in what way?
Ash asked.
Whole rooms were gutted and redone. Walls moved, floors replaced. She said it was her way of coping with the emptiness Margot left behind. I always thought it was extensive, but I never questioned it. Mother had her ways of dealing with things.
I can't shake the feeling that there's something off about these changes. It's not just the aesthetic alterations. It feels like something more substantial has been concealed.
Ash, help me check these walls more closely.
I suggest. We start tapping along the walls, listening intently. The sound changes subtly as we reach a particular section. It's hollow, distinctly different from the solid thuds everywhere. I press my ear against the wall, straining to listen. I hear something unexpected, a faint, rustling sound. It's too deliberate to be dismissed as mere settling of an old house. It's too big, too rhythmic to be a rodent.
Did you hear that?
I ask, looking over at Ash. He nods, his expression turning serious.
Yeah, there's something behind this wall.
Beaumont, observing our actions, comes over, a look of confusion on his face.
What is it? What do you hear?
There's something, or someone, behind this wall.
I reply, my mind racing with possibilities. Mathis looks incredulous.
It's impossible. Just an old house.
Ash stands there, his hand flat against the wall.
This reminds me of my time in Iraq, he says slowly. Insurgents used to build elaborate networks of tunnels, sometimes within the walls of buildings. Hidden passages, secret rooms. It was their way of moving unseen.
Mathis's face goes pale.
Hidden passages in this house?
It's not unheard of in old homes, especially ones with a history like this.
I add, my mind working overtime.
Secret passages were often built for various reasons. Security, privacy, sometimes even for less savory purposes.
But why would my mother need something like that?
Mathis asked, his voice barely above a whisper.
That's what we intend to find out.
I say firmly.
Do you have any access to the blueprints of the house? Particularly of the remodeling done by your mother?
Ash asked. Mathis shakes his head, clearly puzzled by the turn of events.
I don't have them personally, but I can contact the family lawyer first thing in the morning. He might have a copy or know where to find them.
Realizing we can't wait until morning, I pull out my phone and dial our secretary.
Louise, we need your help. Can you bring a couple things from the office?
Louise arrives within the hour, her reliable efficiency shining through once again. She brings a trunk full of equipment, along with her trademark no-nonsense attitude.
Thank you for coming on such short notice, I say.
Of course. What's got you two so worked up?
She asks, handing over the equipment.
Oh, you know, the usual.
I shrug. Louise has been with us long enough to know that's code for our case has taken an unexpected turn. We set up the thermal imaging camera that Louise brought and start scanning the walls of the mansion. The camera, a sophisticated device, detects temperature differences and helps visualize what can't be seen with the naked eye. As I move the camera along the wall, most sections show the cool, consistent temperature of the old stone and plaster. But then, the screen reveals something unexpected. A large, warm pocket within a section of the wall. Ash takes out the endoscopic camera, a small device perfect for peering into tight spaces. He carefully inserts the camera into a small crevice in the suspicious section. The screen attached to the camera flickers to life, a murky, shadowed view of what lies beyond. He navigates the camera through the dark cavity of the wall, the light from its tip casting eerie shadows. The passage behind the wall seems to be a narrow, cramped space, but it's difficult to tell its full extent from the camera's limited perspective. The camera's light flickers across the hidden space, the shadows dancing on the tiny screen. For a moment, it's just an empty void, a silent testament to hidden secrets. But then, something moves. A figure, hunched and barely discernible in the dim light, shuffles into view. The figure is unnervingly gaunt, its movements jerky and unnatural. Its back is to the camera, but there's something profoundly disturbing about its posture, the way it seems to twitch with an unsteady rhythm. Then, without warning, the figure turns, and for a brief, heart-stopping moment, its face is illuminated by the camera's light. It's a visage of despair and terror. Eyes hollow and haunted, skin sallow and stretched taut over sharp bones. The figure's lips part, and it lets out a chillingly pained cry. A sound that seems to echo through the walls of the mansion. As quickly as it appeared, the figure shuffles away, disappearing back into the shadows. We all stand there, frozen. The image of the ghastly figure burned into our minds. Mathis, watching over my shoulder, gasps audibly.
What was that?
Ash's face hardens with concern. Someone's living in your walls. Part 2. I grab the stud finder, a tool capable of detecting changes in wall density, and begin sweeping it across the surface where we'd heard the sounds. The device beeps erratically as it passes over a seemingly innocuous section of the wall. It's cleverly disguised, flush with the rest of the wall, but there's definitely something there. I run my fingers along the edges, feeling for any cracks or seams. There's a slight give in one spot, almost imperceptible.
Ash, here,
I call out, pressing hard against the spot. With a combination of pressure and a bit of maneuvering, a section pops open, revealing a narrow, dark passage. The discovery of the hidden passage sends a shockwave through us.
I had no idea.
Mathis stammers, his voice barely above a whisper. I glance at Ash, who is already pulling a flashlight from his belt, his expression grim but determined.
Those sounds, they were cries of pain,
I say to him, my voice almost pleading.
We need to find out who's in there, what's happening.
Ash meets my gaze. For a moment, he's silent, processing the weight of my words. Then, with a decisive nod, he draws his pistol.
We need to be careful, he says. Stay close to me.
Mathis, still in shock, makes a move to follow us.
I should come with you. This is my family's house.
No, you need to stay here,
I say firmly, my tone leaving no room for argument. Mathis looks like he wants to protest, but my stern glare and drawn sidearm convince him otherwise. He nods, albeit reluctantly. He steps back.
Luis, can you keep an eye on Mr. Beaumont?
I ask, turning towards our elderly secretary.
Of course, Rain.
Luis replied with a nod, her gaze fixed on Mathis. She moves a step closer to him, her posture alert.
And just so we're clear, Mr. Beaumont,
she adds, her voice calm but assertive.
I'm trained in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Any funny business and you'll be on the floor before you know it.
Mathis swallows hard, clearly taken aback by Luis's directness. Satisfied, I turn back to the hidden passage. Ash is already peering inside, the beam of his flashlight cutting through the darkness. The passage is narrow and cramped, the air stale and heavy. The further we venture, the more pronounced the odor becomes. A pungent mix of mildew, decay, and something else. Something distressingly organic. My stomach churns at the smell, and I fight to keep my composure. Ash, though visibly affected, presses on with a grim determination. Suddenly, the narrow beam of the flashlight falls upon horrifying signs of human habitation. Tattered blankets are strewn across the floor, along with empty food cans and water bottles. The walls are scratched with what appears to be tally marks. In the corner, we discover a small makeshift bed, its linens stained and worn. Beside it lies a stack of old books and a battered notebook. I pick up the notebook, flipping through its pages. The handwriting inside is erratic, filled with fragmented thoughts and disjointed ramblings. It speaks of loneliness, despair, and a profound sense of abandonment. As we delve deeper, the passage narrows further, forcing us to move in a crouched position. The beam dances across the walls, throwing ominous shadows that seem to move of their own accord. The sense of being watched is overwhelming. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I catch a glimpse of movement. A fleeting, ghostly figure that scurries by in the periphery of the flashlight's beam. The figure is gaunt, almost spectral. It darts away from the light, moving deeper into the labyrinthian passageways. Ash and I exchange a glance, and, without a word, begin to pursue. The narrow corridor twists and turns, creating a disorienting maze beneath the Beaumont mansion. The figure ahead moves with a desperate, almost feral agility. It's clear that this person knows these passages intimately. We finally manage to corner the figure in a small chamber. It's a dead end, the walls lined with peeling wallpaper, and the floor covered in a thin layer of dust. The figure crouches in the corner, almost nude, save for tattered remnants of clothing clinging to their skeletal frame. Long, disheveled gray hair obscures the face, making it impossible to discern any features. I lower my weapon, signaling to Ash to do the same. We need to handle this delicately. The figure in the corner, hearing my voice, recoils further, pressing herself against the wall. Her voice is hoarse, barely above a whisper, yet filled with a raw, primal fear.
Father, please don't hurt me.
She pleads, her eyes wide with terror.
I promise to behave.
It's okay. We're not going to hurt you.
I say softly, trying to sound as non-threatening as possible. Kneeling down, I cautiously reach out to gently push back her hair, revealing the woman's face. It's a jarring sight.
Lucius,
I exclaim in horror.
Margot.
The years of isolation and neglect have taken a heavy toll on her. Her skin is pallid, almost translucent, and her cheeks are hollow, accentuating the sharp angles of her face. But it's her eyes that capture my attention. Intense, hazel, strikingly familiar. They're the same eyes from the old photo. Embracing Margot's frail frame in my arms, I try to offer comfort to her. Her body is fragile, trembling. I can feel every bone through her thin skin. Margot clings to me, her grip surprisingly strong despite her weakened state. Her breaths are shallow and rapid.
We're going to get you out of here. You're safe now.
I whisper, but the words feel hollow, even to my own ears. Nothing I say can erase the horrors she's faced or return the lost years of her life. Her gaze meets mine, a flicker of recognition in her eyes. For a brief moment, there's a glimmer of the vibrant young woman she once was, the one captured in the faded Polaroid photo. But it's fleeting, and her eyes soon cloud over with confusion and fear. Back in our office, the atmosphere is somber, yet tinged with a sense of accomplishment. We'd done the impossible, found the long-lost Margot Beaumont, an heiress who had vanished into the shadows of her own home. The reward from Mathis Beaumont, as promised, was more than enough to save our business from the brink. Yet, as I sit at my desk, my thoughts linger on Margot. The vast inheritance awaiting her could provide comfort, perhaps even luxury, but the scars of her ordeal, both mental and physical, couldn't be erased by wealth. And then there's Camille Beaumont, who would never face justice for the horrific things she did to her own daughter. I opens the battered filing cabinet, its drawers groaning with the weight of countless stories. I slide the Beaumont file into the solved section, feeling a mix of relief and heaviness.
That's one for the books,
I murmur, glancing over at Ash. Ash is leaning back in his chair, the lines of fatigue evident on his face.
We should grab a drink at the Twisted Pelican. We've earned it,
he suggests, referring to our favorite dive bar tucked away in a quiet corner of the French Quarter. As I close the filing cabinets, I can't help but tease him.
Are you sure you're up for it, old man?
A playful grin spreads across my face.
Watch it, old lady.
I might be getting up there in years, but I can still drink you under the table. He smirks, standing up and stretching his back with a groan.
Laughing, I grab my jacket from the back of my chair.
All right, Ash, challenge accepted. But if I win, you're doing paperwork for a week.
Ash rolls his eyes, but can't hide his smile.
Deal. But when I win, you're making coffee for a month. And none of that weak stuff you like.
We're about to head out when Louise calls out from her desk.
Rain, Ash, you've got another client. Just came in.
I exchange a look with Ash, the Beaumont case still lingering in our bones.
Tell them we'll get back to them first thing tomorrow morning.
Louise nods understandingly.
I'll let them know. You two go ahead and unwind.
I pause for a moment, then turn towards Louise with a smile.
Hey, Louise, why don't you join us at the bar? First round's on us.
It's not every day we solve a case like this,
Ash adds.
Are you sure I won't cramp your style, detectives?
She asks with a playful smirk.
Cramp our style? Chérie, you are our style.
I reply with a laugh. She chuckles.
All right, you've convinced me. Let me just lock up here.
As we step out into the balmy New Orleans evening, the vibrant energy of the city wraps around us like a familiar blanket. Rain Tran.